This is VOA News by remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. More than 355,000 people have died globally from COVID-19, more than 100,000 in the United States, reaching a landmark. The number of confirmed infections is about 0.7 million globally and 5.7 globally and about 1.7 million in the United States. U.S. President Donald Trump has threatened to regulate a shutdown. Social media companies apparently furious over Twitter flagging some of his tweets with fact-check warnings, as in potentially misleading or false. The president wrote, "Republicans feel that social media platforms totally silence conservatives' voices. We will strongly regulate or close them down before we can ever allow this to happen." It is unclear whether that threat suggested he might take legal action. A day earlier, though, he accused Twitter of completely stifling free speech. Twitter on Tuesday took the step of adding the warning badges to Mr. Trump's tweets and about mail-in ballots after the president claimed without evidence that voting by mail would result in fraud. More than 2 million children have returned to class in South Korea Wednesday, despite a spike in new coronavirus cases. Tuesday marked the highest daily number of new infections in well over a month. The country reported 40 new cases as of midnight and 19 the day before. That came as one of the country's biggest online retailers, Coupang, battles an outbreak at a logistics center west of Seoul. At least 36 recent cases have been linked to it, though it was unclear how many of those were reported on the last day. The center's now shuttered. While South Korea has been lauded for its quick and effective response to the pandemic, Wednesday's numbers are among a recent resurgence of cases that sparked fears of a second wave of infections. This is VOA News. A COVID-19 test and trace service is now launching in England this Thursday to help the loosening of lockdown measures. That's according to Prime Minister Boris Johnson. The service, which Johnson said would have a task force of about 40,000 people to test and identify the contacts of anyone who tests positive for the virus, will not initially include the app that is key to finding anonymous contacts. The government did not give a date for when the smartphone technology would be deployed. Anyone with symptoms will be required to take a test, and if positive, they will be asked if they're close contacts, who will be in turn told a specialist tracer to isolate for 14 days, even if they don't have any symptoms. Johnson said the system would initially rely on British people following the advice to self-isolate, but sanctions could be later considered if necessary. Prime Minister Boris Johnson delivered the simple message for the British people to just move on from the row over the actions of his closest government aide, Dominic Cummings. Some still want answers over why Cummings deemed it right to drive his family 250 miles to self-isolate during the UK's lockdown and consequently keep his job. Prime Minister continued to repeatedly back his advisor when answering questions from members of the UK Parliament, and he would not be pursuing further inquiry. The questioning on Dominic Cummings overshadowed the announcement of a test and trace service the UK government is rolling out from Thursday. Disney is beginning to phase in a reopening of its Walt Disney World theme park in Orlando, Florida. That will be starting in July, actually. That's according to a plan released on Wednesday. And phase one doors will open at Magic Kingdom and the Animal Kingdom on July 11th, followed by Epcot Center and Hollywood Studios on July 15th. Orlando will be the first U.S. Disney theme park to reopen after all the parks were shut worldwide back in March. Shanghai Disney, which reopened in early May, has been used as the model for how to reopen. Face coverings will be required for all the employees and guests, and temperature screenings will be conducted at the gate. Park attendance will be limited due to the need for social distancing, and in an attempt to limit human-to-human contact, Disney is encouraging the use of contactless payment systems and expanding digital payment options at food establishments park-wide. Californians looking to get a haircut will have to abide by some new rules. Governor Gavin Newsom said Tuesday barbers could reopen for business in parts of the state with some guidelines in place, but he did joke that his own kids didn't seem to respect those rules. Hair salons employees in 47 of California's 58 counties will be required to wear face masks and encouraged to don goggles. Customers must also wear masks, use sanitizer, hand sanitizer, and follow social distancing rules. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. For the rest of the week, I'll be filling in for James Butte. Today is Thursday, May 28th, and here are the stories we are covering. Alleged Rwanda genocide perpetrator Felicien Kabuga made his second appearance in a Paris court Wednesday.
As the judge was reading some of the crimes that he allegedly committed, he then suddenly said, "All of these replies, I have not killed him. It seems I was working with him." That's why he told in front of the French court today.
Also ahead, we'll hear from Malawi's Attorney General, who is in the hot seat amid a controversy over when that country will hold its next election. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, a judge who was presiding over the corruption trial of the president's chief of staff has suddenly died. South African churches are reopening after the COVID-19 lockdown. Plus, Kenyan authorities say the coronavirus has reached Nairobi's crowded slums.
The figures which we have shared illustrate the rapid rate of transmission in the informal settlements of Nairobi. This means that there is a ranging number of infections in these areas.
That was Kenya's Health Cabinet Secretary Mutahi Kagwe, and an exclusive interview with the head of the Africa Centers for Disease Control. All these stories are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Alleged Rwanda genocide perpetrator Felicien Kabuga made his second appearance in a Paris court Wednesday. He is accused of financing and providing arms to ethnic Hutu militias who killed 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus in 1994. Journalist Nicolas Pinot was in the court and tells VOA's James Butte that Kabuga pleaded not guilty to the charges.
It was his second appearance in front of a French judge, and basically the idea was to know if Felicien Kabuga would be extradited regarding the crime that allegedly he committed in Rwanda. But the judge today in France did not make up his mind yet. He set up a new date, June 3rd, to make his decision regarding this case. What's interesting, what happened today in court is that this is the second time that you see Kabuga in front of the judge. And as the judge was reading, some of the crimes that he allegedly committed, he then suddenly said, "All of this is lies. I have not killed any Tutsis. I was working with them." That's what he told in front of the French court today. And he said that in Kinyarwanda through a translator. What's also interesting is that the French policemen who arrested him, they talk about their investigation and how they tracked him down next to Paris. And they said that he used the name of Run 28 aliases to evade capture.
Kabuka's lawyers have said that they would like for the judge to release him because of his age. Do you think this is likely?
Well, it would be unlikely, and I think that's what the prosecutor made his case in front of the judge. He said, Mr. Kabuga had escaped justice for 26 years, and of course, if we put him out of the jail right now, there's a huge risk that he would be able to escape again. And she made her point that he would create, and I'm quoting, a real unrest in France, in Belgium, and also in Tanzania, in case he would go to Arusha, where the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda used to be before it ended.
So when next is he expected to appear in court again?
So the next date set by the judge would be June 3rd, which is next Wednesday, and that's when we will know if the French judicial system will extradite him through the Hague to the international system that replaced the international court for the Rwanda.
Nicole, thank you very much again for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
That was journalist Nicolas Pinot speaking with VOA's James Butte from Paris, France. Malawi's Attorney General Kalekeni Kafale says the full parliament, not a committee, is mandated under the Constitution to decide when an election should take place. This, as it appears there are uncertainties whether the country will hold the much-anticipated court-mandated presidential election rerun on either June 23rd or July 2nd. The Legal Affairs Committee of the Malawi Parliament had said it accepted a recommendation by the Malawi Electoral Commission to have the election on June 23rd. But Election Commission Chair Jane Ansah resigned last week, prompting the Human Rights Defenders Coalition to cancel a nationwide protest scheduled for today. The Human Rights Defenders Coalition has criticized the Attorney General as a threat to democracy in Malawi. But Kafale says he was only providing legal advice to the Legal Affairs Committee. For more, James Butte spoke with Attorney General Kafale.
There is a provision in the Constitution, that's Section 67, that sets the date for the elections. And the Constitution can provide a date for a separate election of a president where Parliament meets and sets the date. So Parliament is the one responsible for setting the date, not a committee on legal affairs of Parliament. And that's exactly the kind of advice that I provided to the Legal Affairs Committee of the Parliament to say you were wrong in resolving to set a date for the fresh election because you do not have the power. It's the whole Parliament in plenary that has the power.
Mr. Attorney General, I mean, the time is very close for this election. I'm sure the people of Malawi would like to know from you as a legal advisor to the government, when are these elections, June 23rd or July 2nd?
I am not mandated to say when the election will take place. It will be Parliament that will have to set the date. And when setting the date, it has to be aware of the international obligation and as well as its obligation to the people of Malawi to only set such a date as can lead to a genuine election. Listen, the chairperson of the commission resigned. Other commissioners, their term is expiring on the 5th of June, meaning that maybe come the 6th of June, we are going to have a new set of commissioners, a new chairperson of the commission. Procurement of ballot papers hasn't taken place. Training of all the presiding officers in all the 5,002 polling stations hasn't taken place. It is not for me as Attorney General to set a date for the elections because the Constitution doesn't mandate me to do that. Parliamentarians will have to convert with the electoral management body and enact the debt.
Let me ask you, because I had a chance to speak with the Honorable Nsukwa. He's the chair of the Parliamentary Legal Affairs Committee. He said exactly what you said, that the committee only recommended and that the full parliament was going to decide. He also said, which was reported in the papers, that he did not seek legal opinion from you because he said you have been compromised. I don't know what he means, but are you compromised?
People wish I was compromised, but I'm not. I've given advice based on the reading of a provision of the Constitution. Those that have an argument, can they argue against my advice and produce a contrary argument rather than do an ad hominem against me and perceive me as compromised? That's not going to change the letter of the law. I've put across my argument based on the letter of the law.
Let me give you a chance to answer to the criticism by the Human Rights Defenders Coalition, describing you or criticizing you as the biggest deterrent to the entrenchment of democracy and good governance in Malawi. It seems to me you are under fire by this.
They only wish, actually, you are always looking around to label others as enemies, anathema, or whatever. No, that's not going to work. I hold that office by virtue of being appointed to that office. Whatever I say will have to be based on legal argument. Can they produce counter-legal argument rather than declare me the devil? And HRDC is a perpetual litigator. Can people litigate over this point? I don't even have to be in court. Let them argue the point and let the court decide. That's what I told the HRDC. Rather than attacking me personally, they should go for a judicial interpretation. Who is it that sets the date for election?
Kalakeni Kafale is Malawi's Attorney General. He was speaking with VOA's James Butte from the capital, Lilongwe. The judge in a high-profile graft trial involving a key ally of Democratic Republic of Congo's president died suddenly overnight of a heart attack, police said Wednesday. Judge Raphael Yani has presided over the trial of the president's chief of staff, 61-year-old Vital Kamarhe. Kamarhe is accused of embezzling more than $50 million in state funds, and the trial has been screened on live national TV. The AFP news agency quoted Kinshasa police that Judge Yani fell ill at around 2 a.m. and was taken to hospital, where he died as a result of cardiac arrest. Scuffles between youth and police followed the judge's death. For more on Judge Yani's death, I spoke to Carbone Beni, who is an activist with the Filimbi organization in Kinshasa.
The judge's death comes at a very delicate moment when the trial of Vital Kamerhe, chief of staff of the president of the Republic, is taking place, accused of embezzling public funds. It may well be that the death of the judge is also linked to this trial.
It is a huge loss for both the judiciary, but also for his family. He leaves orphans and a widow who didn't deserve this. This death is mysterious because it came at a delicate moment and in a shady circumstances.
Is there any suspicion of foul play in his death? And is there anything that can be done to ensure that the cause of death is determined?
Just so you know, so far there is no evidence that links his death to the Vital Kamerhe trial. But as long as there are no forensic investigations, suspicion will always weigh on people linked to the trial. And you know, Johnson, the only way to be sure is open a judicial investigation into the cause of Mr. Yanni's death and have an autopsy. And I can say to you that at this moment, even his biological family demands an autopsy.
And can you explain the importance of this trial of Vital Kamerhe for the Democratic Republic of Congo?
This trial can be an exemplary trial. The outcome of this trial could dissuade, in the case, all political figures and civil servants of the state from affording to embezzle the money of the state easily. In DRC, you know, impunity is plaguing the socio-political and economic environment of the country.
That was Carbone Beni, who is an activist with the Filimbi organization in Kinshasa. South Africa has allowed places of worship to reopen, with President Cyril Ramaphosa calling for a national day of prayer against the rapidly rising coronavirus infections. The move that comes with stringent restrictions has been overwhelmingly welcomed by church leaders, but also seriously criticized by others. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
The announcement to permit worshippers to start gathering again comes at a time when the number of infections in South Africa just surpassed 24,000, with over 500 deaths. However, in announcing the decision, President Cyril Ramaphosa said the government considered that the closure of places of worship has increased distress as churches were not able to give comfort to the bereaved and the infected.
The faith community is an integral part of South African life and has made a great contribution in the fight against the coronavirus. We recognize and appreciate the important role the faith community has played in the provision of spiritual support and social relief.
Ramaphosa called on all religious groups to embark on a day of prayer on the 31st of May, a day before the country enters an eased level 3 lockdown.
On this day, I call upon all of us to turn our thoughts to all those who have been affected, to also turn our thoughts to the families of those who have lost their loved ones. We should remember those who are working to keep us safe.
Ramaphosa said the reopening, which begins on June 1st, comes with strict conditions. No more than 50 people will be allowed inside a place of worship at any one time. Worshippers and those conducting services are expected to observe social distancing and wear face masks. Places of worship will have to be disinfected before and after every service. Hand sanitizers will always have to be provided to worshippers. Religious leaders across the country are welcoming the decision. Archbishop Thabo Mokgoba, the Anglican Bishop of Cape Town, says churches will do their best to ensure their premises do not become coronavirus hotspots. Some South Africans, however, have criticized the move, saying it will only multiply the infections. But Mokgoba says his community will adhere to all of the conditions.
We'll have to improvise. We'll have to work within the laws and find a way of soaking South African prayer, because our main aim is not to have numbers. We need to be vigilant. We need to ensure that the framework that we've put for ourselves actually works.
However, those opposed to the opening say it will be impossible for government to enforce compliance in all places of worship across all religions in the country. Tusu Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Kenya reported its largest 24-hour rise in COVID-19 cases Wednesday after a major increase in testing. Health Cabinet Secretary Mutahi Kagwe explains the situation on Kenyan television.
Our figures are staggering. We have tested the largest number of samples, over 3,000, over the last 24 hours. We have also registered the highest number of positive Kenyans in 24 hours at 123 persons. For the first time, we have hit a triple digit figure. They are now spread in 35 various hospitals across the country. On another sad note, we have lost 3 more patients, bringing the total number of fatalities to 55.
Kagwe said the new positive cases included a 1-year-old child, underscoring that the virus can infect anyone regardless of age. He said that many of the new cases were found in Nairobi's Mathare and Kibera slums, where hundreds of thousands of people live in close quarters.
The figures which we have shared illustrate the rapid rate of transmission in the informal settlements of Nairobi. This means that there is a ranging number of infections in these areas.
Kagwe warned Kenyans to take the disease seriously and to take measures to protect themselves.
Some of the highest infections come from areas where public transport is the primary means of transportation. Yet, we have noticed that many have reverted back to their old ways of travel, disregarding social distancing rules and not obeying masking guidelines. Please let me remind you of the need to protect yourself and, as I have said, to protect others. You don't know who you are sitting next to. And from the figures we are getting, I think it would be safe to assume that the person you are sitting or standing next to is positive. Once you assume they are positive, you will not want to remove that mask.
For more on the spread of COVID-19 in Kenya, I spoke to Nairobi-based journalist David Lumuria. He first explained to me the implications of the spread of COVID-19 in Kenyan slums.
The implication of this densely populated area like the Mathare and Kibera in these regions is a worrying trend, because these are communities where the social distance has been difficult to really effect. COVID measures have been put in place, but this place are naturally quite crowded. And even within the lockdown, with the cessation of movement in Nairobi, these cases are still rising. In these places, there's danger that this disease could overwhelm the health system.
One thing that Kenyan authorities are doing is asking people to volunteer to get tested. Is this strategy working?
Voluntary testing has its own disadvantage, because not many people are voluntarily going to test.
And why is that? Is that related to the issues of the quarantine centers that Kenya has for people who test positive to stay in?
In the beginning, there were more concerns about paying for quarantine places, because people were avoiding to go there because they thought if they went there, then they could ideally be able to pay for their own quarantine. But I think that was changed when the government announced that government will pay for that. But it goes beyond just volunteering, but also in terms of work, because I think there hasn't been a lot of emphasis being put on employers. We are not seeing what the government is telling the employers to do. Are employers keeping those people who get COVID infected? Do they have their jobs? There's also the social stigma around COVID itself, and people have contracted that. People worried about what would happen after they come out of the quarantine facilities, whether they're cleared or not. Would they be able to get back to their work? So I think that in itself is undermining the efforts to voluntarily be able to go and get tested.
That was journalist David Lumuria in Nairobi, Kenya. As many African countries reopen from COVID-19 lockdowns, the head of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention urges widespread testing as the best way to avoid a surge in new cases of coronavirus. VOA's Solomon Solomon spoke to the director of the Africa CDC, Dr. John Nkengasong, and has this story.
Dr. John Nkengasong, director of the Africa CDC, told VOA, to have a reasonably accurate picture of how the disease is spreading, Africa needs about 15 million tests, or enough to test about 1% of the population. To date, only 1.8 million people have been tested continent-wide.
If we do not know a pandemic, we cannot fight the pandemic. It's like we're at war. If you do not know your enemy, you can't fight the enemy.
In order to bridge the testing gap, the Africa CDC has created the Partnership to Accelerate COVID Testing. The partnership will establish a platform for African countries to pool resources in order to buy diagnostic tools available on the international market. Nkengasong hopes the platform will go live in about a week. To date, the Africa CDC has distributed about 2.7 million tests and has plans to distribute about 900,000 in Senegal this week. Still, Nkengasong said, there are many blind spots which affect the accuracy of overall numbers.
There are certain missing cases out there. Because our surveillance system are weak, our health system are weak, we are certainly missing cases there. The real question is by how much? Okay, by, are we missing it by a whole lot? Or are we missing a few cases here and there? So as we increase our testing ability, we'll be able to answer that question. The concern that we have is what we are not seeing going to harm us.
Africa has recorded a lower caseload than other parts of the globe, with about 117,000 cases of COVID-19 infection and about 3,500 deaths. However, in recent weeks, new cases have been increasing at a rate of about 30%. One headline-grabbing example took place in Ghana earlier this month when more than 500 people tested positive in one day at a fish processing factory.
Now suggests that we are on the increasing side of the slope. So we are not yet at the top of the slope, or we are not decreasing. So I think that has to be put in context. And this implies clearly that we cannot be complacent.
To combat this worrying trend, Nkengasong said the Africa CDC is leading an effort to recruit and train 1 million foot soldiers, or people who can hit the streets to do contact tracing. He also stressed the need to expand health systems to meet the additional need and to protect them from being overloaded.
The harm that if we do not protect our healthcare workers, that it may have on our overall ability to provide care for the community is huge, okay? And this includes the damage that it can cause to our HIV, malaria, tuberculosis, and immunization programs there. So these are all things that we must, the challenges that we face across the board.
Solomon Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
That's it for this Thursday, May 28th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of Managing Editor James Butte, producer Nicole Beckford, and the rest of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great day.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa. Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.